Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. We have with us today Michael Bungay Stanya. He is Australian, which is why I pronounce his last name with that little twist. He wrote most recently The Coaching Habit, Say Less, Ask More, and Change the Way You Lead Forever. He's an excellent guy. He's had an interesting history. And if you ever meet him, you can ask him why he was banned from his high school graduation for the balloon incident. He was a Rhodes Scholar, left Australia 22 years ago, and he's written about 5 books, I believe, and this one is about coaching. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Peter, look, I'm really happy to be here. I'm a follower of your work. I admire it, so it's great to be in conversation with you here.
I love the book as well.
Thank you.
So tell us, what's the big idea of the book?
Okay, so the way we make money, the way we do business at Box of Crayons is helping busy managers coach. And our belief is that if you can't coach in 10 minutes or less, you don't have time to coach. So the key idea behind this book is, look, if you can master 7 good questions and you understand how to make them into a regular habit, you're going to level up in terms of your impact as a manager and a leader, with the general outcome is that you get to work less hard but have more impact.
And this was a hard book for you to write, even though you know the topic, you know, maybe better than any of the other books you've written.
Right. You know, so we were talking about this before we went on air, and I was saying, you know, my other books, they've been quite quick to write. I got an idea and the words flowed and the muse spoke to me and I was a beam of light down from heaven, and it was great. This book, I thought I knew what I wanted to say and I had to go writing it, and I wrote basically a pretty bad version of the book. And then I wrote another version, which was also a pretty bad version of the book. And then I gave it to my editor at the time, and she went, well, I don't love this. Why don't you try and write something like this? So I wrote a bad version of the book, which I thought she wanted to read, which was still a bad version of the book. And finally, I kind of went, okay, what do I really want? What's the, you know, there's this great quote from Einstein, you probably know, Peter, things should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. So I went, so what's the book that is elegant, practical, lean, and useful? And this time, the fourth time round, it actually flowed. It was relatively quick to write after the first 4 years of failing to write it.
And, you know, it's interesting because I can't help but think that as I listen to the story, it's a little bit of self-coaching, meaning that you tried to listen to other people's advice and you got, you know, it is what this book is about. You tried to listen to other people's advice and it wasn't working for you. And it took a sort of pause for you to then listen to yourself and figure out what book it was that you wanted to write.
You know, I would say, I mean, I'm very influenced by the work of Peter Block, and
I thought you were going to say Peter Bregman for a second, and I was getting all excited. But Peter Block is a great, great, smart thinker.
And I put anybody who's called Peter up on a pedestal, obviously, especially Peter B. You know, it all kind of connects like that. But I once heard Peter Block say that he saw his work as helping people generate adult-to-adult relationships in the workplace, giving people responsibility for their own freedom is another way he put it. And when you ask yourself, what is an adult-to-adult relationship? Because it's one of those phrases that sounds good, but what does it actually mean? One of the definitions I've heard that I really like is being able to ask for what you want, knowing that the answer may be no. And I think for most of us in our organizational life and just in life in general, we're very influenced by trying to respond to what other people want, and we're not always clear what we want. And if we don't have that kind of certainty or groundedness or chance to reflect on what is it that I want, you get kind of pulled wherever the current takes you or wherever the wind blows you. By getting clear on what you want, you're then in a stronger position to then have a adult-to-adult relationship to go, okay, if you want this and I want that, what's the outcome that we're going to have here? And it was getting clear on that that it actually allowed me to say, good, now I've got this clarified. That gives us a path forward from here.
It seems so obvious. Why is it so hard?
To get clear on what we want?
Well, and to ask for it.
Yeah.
Meaning to be able to say, you know, I sort of think of myself, and I think I was just thinking about a book that I'm working on, and I think perhaps, but I don't even know this for sure, that my agent is thinking he wants me to write something else. And I find myself sort of drawn to writing what he wants me to write and hesitant to say, here's the book I want to write. And I, you know, I've written a bunch of books. You've written a bunch of books. I should be skilled at this. I'm certainly going to do it. But why is it so hard?
Well, that's a really good question. I think there's a number of things going on. And it could be a mix of all of these, or one of these could be a more dominant piece. One is, you know, lots of us are people pleasers. We want to be liked. And there's an anxiety that by asking for what you want, you set up conflict. And so being comfortable with asking for what you want, knowing that the answer may be no, is part of it. And being able to put that out, I think that's part of it. I think the other piece is an external piece, which is other people always sound a whole lot more convincing than you do. Because in your own head, you've got all the ambiguity and the uncertainty and the doubt and the imposter syndrome and all that kind of stuff and the way it mixes up. Whereas the person on the other side of the table always seems to be clear and focused and absolutely certain in what's really required here. You know, there's a line from the poet Yeats, and I'm going to maim this slightly, but it says something like, the evil are full of certainty and the good are full of doubt. And it's a bit like that, which is because you know your own frailties, you can be a little suspicious of your own certainties. And actually, that's actually a very powerful place to be in many ways, because you don't have that arrogance of certainty and like, I'm definitely right and everybody else is wrong. But you also have to manage that as well.
You know, and it's really what you wrote the book about in many ways, right? Which is how managers can still be supportive but get out of the way at the same time. And I do have questions around this, because I know, and I've been proven wrong in this, where I have an idea and I go to someone who knows more than me. Let's just say I go to my publisher, for example. We're talking about books. And her view was, you know, I think actually we should do X, Y, and Z. And I have a different view. But I think to myself, you know, I've written, you know, three books and a bunch of article things. She's put out, you know, probably hundreds.
Right.
So she knows more than I do.
Right.
And it's not necessarily true, meaning when you kind of, you know, hindsight is 20/20. But when you look at it, I actually think I might have been right in that situation. But how do we, both as the manager, handle the sense that actually we have done this 100 times and we kind of know how it'll play out, and as the person being coached, handle the boldness or the courage of saying they may have done it a couple 100 times, but I'm actually going to go with what I'm thinking here?
Yeah. Well, I think this is such a good question, and there's all sorts of things bubbling up in my head around this. Part of, I think it is, as a manager and a leader, having to think about what's the outcome that you want here. Is the outcome for you to be right, or is the outcome for you to grow your people and make them more self-sufficient and increase their capacity?
So I think it's actually a tricky question with manager. As a coach, as a pure coach, it's easy to say, I want this person to grow.
Yeah, sure.
As a manager, if I'm your manager, I'm accountable for your results. Meaning if you don't perform, then ultimately that's my bottom line.
That's
so I
right.
think coaching as a manager is very tricky in answering that question.
I think it is. And here's the default behavior that we're trying to shift. If there's a fundamental default behavior that the book addresses, is that's true. And this is not saying that managers should just let people go off and do whatever the hell they want just to find their own journey and follow their own bliss. But the dominant way of behaving is for managers to leap in and become the solution provider, the advice giver, the direction setter immediately. You come to me with a challenge, and as you don't even know all the details, I've only just started telling you, but you've already stopped listening to me because you've now got the answer and you're just waiting for me to stop talking so you can tell me the answer. And what we're just trying to do is slow that down a little bit. It's not to say that you let people wander off the reservation, but if you just say, let's have a 5-minute conversation, let's see how far you go. And I know that I've got the wisdom to pull you back from a precipice if it's a precipice. I've got the experience to say, look, is this an above the waterline mistake or a below the waterline mistake that's about to happen? Because maybe I'll let the above the waterline mistake go, because that's where experience comes from. But I'm going to not let you make a below the waterline mistake, because then we all sink on the ship together and that's not a great outcome. So it's a question in part of managing that tension between the need to get stuff done and the need to grow the capacity and potential of people. And if it is only ever about how do we get the answer the fastest, a couple of things happen. One is the potential and the capacity of the people you're leading never get fully developed. Secondly, you become a bottleneck. Thirdly, you're actually not as good as you think you are, and your answers aren't always the right answers anyway. And if you give the other people a bit of room, they're probably going to come up with the same or similar answer to you, maybe even a better and a different answer.
How do you deal with the frustration possibly of the person that you're coaching who's sitting there kind of in some ways guessing what you want them to say if you have the answer?
Yeah.
And they're feeling in a sense of, look, if you know where I want to get to, just tell me and let's move on, mm-hmm. as opposed to making me go through this.
You know, that's great. And, you know, so often there's fake coaching that goes on. You know, it's like, I'm going to ask you a question and then you're going to answer me. And because it's not the right answer, I'm going to ask the question again until you finally get the thing I actually just want to tell you. And that's not really coaching. That's really just often giving advice with a question mark attached. You know, have you thought of, it's not actually a great question. It's just, here's my solution, but let me try and make it sound like a question for you. So it's tricky that, because what you're pointing to is a really interesting place to look, Peter, which is about the power dynamic, which is if there's been a pattern of behavior, which is, you know, we're having a conversation, your role as the person I'm leading is just to tell me what I want to hear. It's hard then to shift into that coaching relationship. So, you know, in some ways it's about, so start in the easy place, start in the small place, and sometimes speak to what's happening, which is like, you know what, Peter, you know, as I reflect on how I've been working with you, kind of I've been just telling you what to do or kind of going, just tell me what I want to hear. But you know what? I'm now exhausted. I'm overwhelmed. I'm a bottleneck and we're underperforming as a team. So we need to do something differently. So let's try this out. I'm actually going to genuinely ask questions and I'm genuinely interested in what you want to hear. And if you take that down to a very specific habit, here's a really specific habit that people might find useful to integrate into their daily management style. Peter comes to me and he goes, Michael, how do I do the blah, blah, blah? Because this is what I've been doing for years now. I just come to you, ask a question, you give me the answer. Michael, how do I do the blah, blah, blah? And here's what I say. Peter, that's a great question. And I've got some ideas on how to do it, which I'll share with you. But before I do, just out of curiosity, what are your first ideas of how to approach that? And then whatever you say, I'm going to nod my head and look interested. And then I go, that's brilliant. I like that. What else could you do? And again, whatever you say, I'm going to nod my head and look interested. And then I go, yeah, fantastic. Anything else that's on your mind about how you could approach this? And then I go, I like all of these. Let me add an idea or two. You could also think about that. And what that is, that's a habit. That's a script. Somebody comes to you and goes, how do I do the thing? You go, great question. I've got some ideas. I'll share them with you. But before I do, what are the first thoughts you've got? And what else? And what else? Cool. Let me share mine.
I love it. And it's one of the things that I enjoyed about this book, because I think it's very simple and it's very straightforward. And I also think that, we're in a setup as managers, right? You're my employee. You come to me. I'm a manager. And you say, I have a problem you want to solve. I want you to solve. And what you really want is for me to solve that problem.
Right.
And what I really want is to like be a good manager. And if I'm add a good value, manager, yeah. I add value. I solve your problem. And I solve your problem. And you walk away happy because, you know, you have had your question answered. And I walk away feeling like a mighty strong manager.
Yeah.
And it's a dynamic that is so easy to reinforce.
Yeah.
And yet, what it does is build dependency.
Yeah, exactly.
And ultimately, as managers, our goal is to create independently capable teams. That's our goal as managers.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to do that, if we're going to build independent capability, and I also think it's okay to just say, hey, I do have some answers. A, they may not be the right answers. And B, if I just give you my answers, you're going to come back to me tomorrow for answers, and I want to do other things with my time.
Exactly. You know, like, I actually have a job beyond just managing
you. And I want you to be more capable. This is a goal. So that's great. I love it. And it's interesting. I have to say it's fun, Michael, to speak with you because, you know, we both, in a sense, run coaching companies. And
And
I don't think we've had this kind – I know we haven't had this kind of dialogue before, but it's something I want to continue in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting.
As well.
I suspect we're going to end up violently agreeing with each other as we go through the conversation.
Exactly.
What might be interesting to the folks listening in the book and speaking to your great insight around dependence versus independent. There's a model in the book which I love. It's almost at the heart of the book, which is called the drama triangle. It's got its roots in something called transactional analysis, which is a slightly dated therapeutic model. And a guy called Stephen Karpman developed this simpler, more useful version. And it basically says, look, when a relationship becomes dysfunctional, if you like, when it's not an adult-to-adult relationship, three roles play out. There's the victim, the persecutor, and the rescuer. And what's great about this model, you know the saying, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So this is a wrong but useful model. But what's great about it is you immediately know what a victim, somebody playing the victim role looks like, what somebody playing the persecutor role looks like, what somebody playing the rescuer role looks like. And you can probably guess the disadvantages and the advantages to playing each one of those roles. We play all three of these roles all the time, but we tend to have a default role. Now, when we do our training programs around this and we have the triangle set up on the floor and we get people to go and stand by the role that you think you play most often, what happens is 90 to 95% of the people charge towards the rescuer role. And there's this great laughter of recognition, which is like, oh my God, we're all rescuing everybody. And when we have this conversation, you know, doing a kind of Dr. Phil moment, so how's that working for you? People go, honestly, not only am I exhausted and overwhelmed and frustrated, but I've also realized that when I'm playing the rescuer role, I actually create victims. I actually create persecutors. And this is to the very point that you're making, which is this dynamic. Somebody comes to your help, goes, how do I do this? And you do the thing for them or you give them the answer. Feels good in the short term, but really builds long-term dysfunctionality in the relationship and doesn't allow for that independence and self-sufficiency that we know as the outcome that people should be striving for.
It's great. I love it. I love that example. I'd like to actually do that myself. It's an interesting...
It's a humbling experience. It's a humbling experience.
And I absolutely do that. I run to the rescuer role and I get exhausted.
Right.
One final question I want to ask is, you know, as I was reading the book and I was looking at your very first question, which I think is a great question. It's a very, you know, it's not an atypical question, right? The Kickstarter question went to start with coaching with what's on your mind. I do wonder, because I noticed this in our own coaching, is that when we just start a coaching process and say to someone what's on your mind, they'll talk about what's on their mind. Oftentimes, that's a current problem that they're currently facing. Mm. On the other hand, one of the great benefits of coaching and why people come to coaching is to say, I'm not focusing where I should focus. Right. I should be focusing on the future. I should be focusing on what I'm creating. And one of the things that we direct our coaches to do a lot is to take control a little bit more of that beginning of the conversation and to say, rather than focus on what you're dealing with right now, how about focusing on where you're trying to get to? And let's look at what's standing in that way. And I wonder what your thoughts are about taking a little more control over the beginning of that conversation.
Yeah. So I think it's worth differentiating what an external coach, an executive coach might be doing and what their agenda might be, as opposed to a manager in the moment, understanding that every interaction they have with the people around them, who they lead and their peers and their bosses, can be a more coach-like experience. And I think often one of the things that's most powerful about an executive coach is you create that space to go, let's get beyond the burning fire at the moment. Let's look at that bigger picture and where that might be going. And the book is really written for not the executive coach, but for the busy manager who's trying to be more coach-like. And in that quest time, getting to what's on your mind is often a way of getting more deeply into that conversation about what's most important to them in the moment.
Makes sense.
However, to your point, you know, the jargon in the coaching world is the difference between coaching for performance and coaching for development. Coaching for performance, the metaphor I use is, it's the fire. Coaching for performance is the fire that needs to be put out or built up or banked or whatever you need to do with fires. Coaching for development is when you focus on the person who's putting out the fire or dealing with the fire. And the coaching and the leadership that people remember tends to be the coaching for development stuff, because actually that's where the growth happens. That's where the self-reflections happen. That's where the stepping in potential happens. That's where people give them the push or give them the hug or whatever they require to step up to a better version of themselves. But that's hard to get to because our organizations are so busy that it all feels about the fire, the fire, the fire the whole time. So the twist on this is, if you're a manager, is to add just two words to the questions that you ask. And those two words are, for you. So what's the difference, Peter? I could ask you, okay, we've got this thing that's going on. What's the challenge here? That's going to get a certain answer out. But if I go, okay, we've got this thing going. What's the challenge here for you, Peter? Actually, the focus starts shifting from the fire to the person who's dealing with the fire.
I love that.
And that's where you start getting that more personal, that bigger picture. The coaching school I went to talked about little A agenda versus big A agenda. So moving to that big A agenda growth piece by asking for you, what's the challenge here for you? You know, what's the big issue here for you? What's difficult about this for you? Gets a different type of conversation going.
That's incredibly useful in the moment too. And it actually shaped the book for me a little bit as I heard you saying that in some ways, in the book is a response to saying, here is a moment. A moment is an employee comes to you and says, I have a problem.
Right.
How can you handle that moment in a way that not only gets you to an answer, but develops their capability?
Brilliant. That's great. Wish I'd said that myself.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. It's so fun to talk with you. And I honestly want to do this much more often, whether it's on the podcast or not. Tell people how they can get in touch with you or how they can reach out.
Sure. So our place on the web is Box of Crayons. That's boxofcrayons.biz, B-I-Z or B-I-Z, depending on what part of the world that you live in. And if you go there, everything, all roads lead from there. And of course, you can find copies of the book on Amazon and all good booksellers.
The book is The Coaching Habit, Say Less, Ask More, and Change the Way You Lead Forever. It is a quick read. It is an easy read, but that doesn't mean that it is simple. It's actually a really highly valuable book, and I encourage you to get it. Thanks so much for being with us, Michael.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.